But first, for most of her life, my next guest has been longing for her father to die. She would imagine getting the phone call and fantasize about cracking open some champagne. But then she decided to take him to court and it all changed. Suddenly, she desperately needed him to stay alive. She wanted him to live long enough to be found guilty of child sex abuse and rape. That's her rape and her abuse. Fee Reed's story is distressing. If you've got children at home, you might want to distract them for the next 20 minutes or so. But let's talk further with Fee. Freelance writer and student nurse joins us from Truro. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeremy.
And one particular date this story pivots on, which is the 9th of January 2013. You went into a police station in Penzance to report the theft of your son's bicycle.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it was a fairly routine kind of visit to the police station, I guess. I was just telling the woman officer at the time, you know, the details that it had been locked, it had been captured on CCTV footage, blah, blah, blah. So after that was kind of done, I just said to her at the end, well, actually, there's another matter that I'd really appreciate your help with. And I said, I want to press charges against my father for childhood sexual abuse. And I think that was probably the most difficult sentence I've ever had to kind of dredge up in my life.
That time last year, you were what kind of age, Fee?
Well, I'm 48 now, so right. I would have been 47.
So you're going back away, and it's been part of your life for a long time, but you hadn't spoken about it.
It's not that I hadn't spoken about it. I've had sort of episodes where I've had counselling, and I've obviously shared that that background with partners I've had and very, very close friends, but I'd never taken the steps to make it a sort of a legal matter.
So take us back to your childhood and tell us about your father and what kind of man he appeared to be, well, to those he met who didn't know him.
He was a very respected dentist, a dental professor. He was the dean of the university in Adelaide in South Australia, where I grew up. Published, you know, thousands of research papers. Was seconded to Hong Kong in the restorative dentistry department there for 3 years. So in all external purposes, he was a very bright, high achiever, successful, very clever man.
And what was he really like?
Well, he was a crap father on just about every level, and I'm not just talking about the specific childhood abuse. He was very distant, emotionally unengaged, a workaholic, I suppose you would call him, you know, shut himself in his study when he wasn't at work and had very little to do with sort of normal everyday family life.
And what did he do to you as a child?
Am I allowed to say on air?
Well, as delicately as you can.
Okay. It began, I suppose, with what would appear to be a very innocent bedtime story routine. And if you bear in mind that my relationship with him wasn't this, you know, happy-go-lucky, loving kind of normal family situation, it was very rare for him to sort of show any, what, you know, in inverted commas, affection. I suppose that was the grooming sort of phase, where he would come into my room, pretend to read stories. Then it escalated to climbing into my bed, taking my nightie off, and, you know, to go through the gamut very quickly. It was inappropriate touching, kissing, penetration, digital penetration. Cunnilingus made me perform fellatio on him, and it culminated in episodes of anal rape.
Right, and this is your age then, is under 10, is that right?
Bizarrely enough, because I Sorry, I'm quite stressed at the minute. Because I had suppressed a lot of the memories at the time, and I only had a sort of an awakening, an awareness of what was going on when I hit puberty, and suddenly appreciated that this I had strange memories and connections and associations, and like a knowledge that I shouldn't have had at that age. And it sort of, you know, unrattled, and eventually I kind of realised that something hugely significantly wrong had taken place, and these were sexual acts, and I had been a very young child, and I'd pinpointed that age as being 10 in my head all this time, you know, until I'd, even when I rocked up at the police station and made the original claim, in my sort of logical head it was when I was 10, because I couldn't remember anything before and I couldn't recall any incidences happening after that age. But during the process of the investigation, it became crystal clear actually that the episodes took place when I was between the ages of 4 and 8, when my mother was absent from the family home. So I was much, much younger than I'd originally believed.
And I noticed from something you wrote that you read all the Agatha Christies at the age of 12. Fun enough, I did too, and you read them for a different reason.
Yeah, I was a voracious reader. I think it's one of those things you do when you're an unhappy child. You kind of escape in the fantasy world of books. But I made a beeline towards these particular books because of her incredibly clever writing of murderers that... well, they almost got away with it if it wasn't for Hercule Poirot. So I read all of them in order to kind of concoct what I believe would be the perfect murder that I'd be able to get away with. And it's a bit sounds a bit macabre, but it was
it's a child doing it. So not, yeah. So after what you've described, it sounds completely understandable. And so we go through all those years, and you can tell us a bit about your struggle. But then we get to the police station, and you say to this must have been astonished officer, "Okay, I've got something else, not just my son's bicycle, but I want to report this as well." And did they take you seriously?
Absolutely. What I told her was, I was wishing to write my own statement and wondered if they would kind of rubber stamp it and, you know, make it official as having been seen by a police officer, because the difficulty with my circumstances are this abuse took place in Adelaide, in Australia, halfway around the world. Here I was in England. I didn't really know how to begin to, start any of this legal process. So I thought if I just had it substantiated, I'd chuck it in the post, send it off to the vice squad, and allow things to take their course.
And am I right in thinking, Fee, that it was partly the Jimmy Savile story that made you think that people might listen?
Jeremy, you're sort of correct there. That had kind of an influence on why perhaps I came forward then. But it was more to do with the media saturation, sort of October, November time. It was almost like I was being bombarded with this painful kind of reminders, I guess, that what had happened, that I tried to bury. I tried very successfully to keep it buried on and off over my lifetime. But it was in the papers, it was on the TV, I'd be driving in my car and the news would come on the radio. I even heard someone say some really sick jokes about Jimmy Savile. They were sort of doing the rounds at the time, and I couldn't switch it off. You know, it was just relentless, and obviously brought up all these intense feelings and emotions. And my when you said at the start about wanting my father to die and pop the champagne and dance on his, you know, virtual grave from this side of the world, I realised then that, you know, Jimmy Savile had died, and he very, very nearly got away with it. And then after all this outpouring of victims who came forward and said, you know, how this man had destroyed their lives, and yes, they were able to tell their truth, but ultimately, you know, Jimmy Savile got away with it and died and lived his life without ever facing any of the responsibility for his behaviour.